Show Recaps Theater presents another double feature from Ariel and Grace talking about Spencer and Last Night in Soho. What did Grace and Ariel think of the movies? Aha, I'm not going to spoil that for you. You're just going to have to enjoy the show.
Well, hello. Welcome to another episode. I am Ariel. I am here with my co-host, Grace. Grace, how are you?
I'm good. Ariel did not tell me we were doing a bit. He didn't tell me. I would have been all in on the bit. Hello.
What are you talking about? There's no bit. This is how we are. This is our normal.
It's Mrs. Doubtfire week. Oh, hello. I didn't know we were watching Mrs. Doubtfire.
I only watched Mrs. Doubtfire.
I watched it twice.
I thought we were going to talk about it in two different voices. That's what our two slots were going to be.
It's British week.
It's British week here on Great British Bake Off. No, here on Fashion Week Theater. I think I will give myself permission to come in and out of this horrid accent that I'm doing. I apologize. I apologize to all the people who talk like this normally. I'm so sorry, everybody. I do apologize. The reason I am speaking in such a ridiculous accent is because I feel compelled to by the two movies that we are covering. The first one being Spencer and the second one being Last Night in Soho. Two very, very British movies.
Strong female leads. There's a lot of connections between these two movies.
I mean,
that we watched.
It's almost like we planned it on purpose. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, everybody.
Both women are being haunted. It's great. It's very, it's very fitting. Yeah.
It's very scary. I'm so sorry. Clearly, my accent is the scariest part.
Yeah, that's true.
This whole thing. We were eating our biscuits, but British biscuits, not like
having a cuppa,
not American.
That's
yeah,
a thing
but
they say, right?
The cuppa. Yeah, cuppa? I think everybody loves tea except Ted Lasso.
True.
I think that's the only exception. I don't drink coffee. I only drink tea. So in that sense, I am extremely British.
Is that true? You don't drink coffee?
Yeah, I'm not a coffee person. It doesn't really do anything for me. Like, I can like drink it right before bed. I mean, the one thing it does do now that I'm in my older age, it gives me heartburn. But even before that, even when I was, still young and in my 20s, I didn't need it. I was like, I don't need coffee unless I was like super hungover. Are you a big coffee person?
Yeah, I love coffee, but I think I have the same thing where like it doesn't really like I can drink it at any time of the day. But I think that's more so like leaders, like my family, we could just sleep whenever. Like my brother notoriously joked when I told him, yeah, I'm doing a movie coverage podcast. He's like, that's so great. You'll get to talk about half the movie and you can talk about how you fell asleep for the second half of the movie. And I'm like, oh, I'm much better.
Excuse him. Yes, excuse me. Somebody get the royal guard on this man for saying such horrible things about you.
I can watch a whole movie, Drew. But yeah, I think it's much more that like leaders are like very good at sleeping. Less so than like the coffee is it just totally outweighs the caffeine effects of coffee. But I love coffee. I love it a lot. Yeah.
I mean, do I love coffee? Yeah. And I mean, I liked the only times I liked drinking coffee were like the times where I put a lot of sugar in it. And then that's like, I got to ask, you got to ask yourself the hard questions. Like, are you really doing this for the right reasons? Or are you just like eating a pastry, basically?
I'll tell you a very easy way to cut out all the sugar in the coffee. Like when I got addicted to coffee, I put sugar in it, and then I got diagnosed with diabetes. It's very quick. You like can cut out the sugar so quickly when you have diabetes.
Is that all it takes?
It's just one little trick that doctors hate. Listen, I guess they love it. I guess they love it. Actually. I guess they don't. Anyway, yeah, I got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, not because I ate too much sugar. Just because my immune system wanted to mess with my body. If anybody hears pump noise, little beeps during every podcast I do ever, that's because that's my diabetes.
It's an Easter egg. It's a fun Easter egg for anybody who wants to go back to any great. They're not an all, so don't drive yourself crazy looking for them.
Anyway,
but every once in a while you'll hear a very friendly beep.
Josh should let me edit other podcasts and let me put the noise in other ones that I'm not in. I'm like, oh, it's like, Grace on this?
It's like, where's Waldo? Like, yeah. Wait, is that? Yeah. That's gotta be Grace. Yeah. Is she hiding in the wings waiting to come on?
Anyway. Anyway, so that's how I cut my sugar. That's how I cut sugar out of my, you know what? I don't have coffee at the movies though. There's something about it like being dark and I don't know. I like a good Diet Coke at the movies.
Diet Coke sounds lovely with some ice. Even though I also don't drink soda, similar to your coffee. But I appreciate things. Speaking of, it's funny, you were mentioning like coffee and movies, and I'm thinking like about how the fact that like I went to go see the Eternals, I think it's just called Eternals, excuse me. Yeah. This past weekend, and I had like a 7 p.m. showing one night, and then I was like, the movie's long. And then there was a 9 a.m. the next morning. I was like, ooh, what if 9 a.m.? And of course I immediately switched, because my thing is always like,
you like the morning movie.
Fall asleep. Yes, 9 a.m. Okay, so it's very easy to get like a 10:30 movie.
Yeah.
But a 9 a.m. is like, oh my God, it's like Christmas. It's like Christmas for me. Like, it's early enough that you feel like, wow, this is such a treat. Like, I don't know, maybe people will listen to this and be like, wow, he's unhinged. But for me, it's like, wow, I get to wake up and basically the first thing you do is go to the movies. But it's not like so early. I'm a morning person, so it's not like early for me.
I would love that. Just the movie theater near me isn't popular. They don't start showing movies until noon. So
yeah. Oh yeah. It was only because it's very like show specific. Obviously Eternals is MCU. It's like a whole lot of money. So like we got to get as many showings in, but other times there'll be like a movie that no one cares about and they don't start until much later. So
yeah, fair enough.
I don't always get lucky. But speaking of lucky, we are lucky enough now to, be talking about Spencer, a movie. I won't bury the lead, a movie that I liked a lot. The director, Pablo Larraín, starring, of course, Kristen Stewart, Timothy Spall, and Jock. I think it's Jack, but in the accent it's Jock. Jacques Millen.
Yeah,
this movie, I will say I was like personally very
you're involved in this in the stuff.
Why do you think I can speak with this accent? I was there.
Stunner revelation on the podcast.
I was there during the filming.
You were involved.
And in the real world in 90. Wow. Well, I was born in 87. So, wow, I was all of six when this movie, or I guess the story being told.
This movie, it takes place in December 1991. So if I was around, I would have been a little baby. It would have been a little like 4-month-old baby. So, yeah, I was not
so
in the
good.
Movie.
And
yeah.
Look how good the movie is. You were so good in it, Grace.
Thanks.
Your part.
Thanks.
So now that we've talked about it a little bit, what are your like overall, I guess, non-spoilery takes on this movie? Did you enjoy it?
I did really enjoy it. I thought it was really well done. I like the idea of like I didn't watch the trailer for this. Like all I knew was that Kristen Stewart's gonna play Princess Diana, and I wasn't sure, and I really liked the movie, like basically takes place over just the course of a few days, right? And so we're really like diving in to a specific time, and I thought that was like a really smart choice, because I think like folks who watch this, I presume people have like mostly watched The Crown, you know, so I feel like we like in that season had just covered a lot of Princess Diana content, and so I feel like people like sort of know-ish the story. I don't want to, you know, maybe that's me being old, but so I thought it was really smart to not try to tackle all of it and just sort of put, you know, watch her for, you know, 3 days in time, and really show like how much she was struggling. I thought it was like really, really well done. Kristen Stewart is really, really good in this movie. And this is really like her movie. Like there's a couple other performances that are pretty good, but Kristen Stewart is like phenomenal. I think she'll get like Oscar nominations for this. So
if there is justice in the world, like I think I agree. I mean, I already said it, but I really did enjoy this movie, and we have to call out Kristen Stewart's performance. Like, to your point, I agree completely. She is the movie, like, and not just because the movie is essentially told from her point of view and has a lot of like her, not necessarily private thoughts, but a lot of her like imagining things, a lot of her almost as like as if her imagination is like exploding off of the screen. We should say it's like a, it's, I think at the beginning it said a fable of a true tragedy is the way they put it. So it's like a fictionalized version of a real weekend. And obviously all these characters are real, but you know, these people weren't in the rooms. But I kind of, she was so good. I wasn't expecting much from her, or rather what I should, that sounds wrong. What I meant to say was I wasn't expecting like anything from her, and God, I'm not saying it right. I had no expectations, period. I can't make it sound like my expectations were low. I had no expectations of her one way or the other. I think I'd seen the trailer a million times, which is why I was like super excited about the movie and hoping it was good. But she is like undeniably great. Like you can, I think you can make the argument whether or not she quote unquote does Diana well. But I think regardless, she disappears into this role. Like, I do not see Kristen Stewart. I see this person that she's creating. Her version of Diana, I think, is so, feels so lived in, and it's so effective. And like, it kind of, it blew me away. Like I said, I wasn't expecting to feel that way about her performance specifically.
Yeah, I don't, you know, this movie, like, there are some co-stars in it, like Timothy Spall is, he's been in a bunch of the Harry Potter films, there's Peter Pettigrew, but he's in this film, and he's sort of the bad guy, you know, in
Heavy Rotation. Yeah, as much as you can be, yeah.
But gosh, like, his role is, like, extremely minor compared to Kristen Stewart, like Diana in this movie, and I think that's a risk. It's a risk to like have so much of the focus just be on Diana, especially when Diana has such a presence like about her and her story and what happened to her. Like, I do feel like as somebody who like, I, you know, I don't like have this like memory. I was born in 91. So I don't have this like memory of like Diana as a member of the royal family. My like memory of Diana is like, she died, unfortunately. And then as you like grow up, you know, you learn kind of like what happened to her, how this was, you know, how she was treated, and you know, the mental health struggle she was going through at the time. But to put so much weight on like one singular performance in this movie only works if that performance is really well done, and it obviously is really well done here. So go see it if you can in the theaters. I think it's worth it. It's really well done. It's great.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an indie film, I guess, technically. So it's not, they're not showing it everywhere. But if you can see it, I would for sure recommend running to see it. It is for sure an experience. Yeah. So yeah, let's get into it.
Let's open the curtains.
Spoilers, Diana dies. No, I'm sorry. That's a bad joke. But like to that point though, that is, and you already alluded to this a little bit, that's what's like this dark cloud that is over the entire movie, is that you know that she only has a few more years left in her life, because of real world events that we know. Obviously, she died in 97, I believe.
Yeah.
So we're in the last like 5 or 6 years of her life in this movie, and it really is like, it's such a I'm a sucker for a tragedy. I'm a sucker for a tragic story, whether it's fictionalized, whether it's real or not. Like, it doesn't matter to me. Like, when it works, it works. And like, it really is so sad. Like, in her interactions with her children, who are so young in this movie. I mean, they were young when she died. Obviously, they were younger at this point when she was still alive. It's so tragic. It's so like, it's weird to call it sweet, but it really is like sweet to see her. Like, we got all these private moments between her and her kids that I think, obviously, you know, who can say if they really happened, but she's a mom, like, and she loved her kids, and like, obviously moments like this happened. It was just really sweet to see
the Christmas night scene where they are sitting around, there's the candles, and they're playing Sergeant Major or whatever little game, you know, the little cute game where they're like calling like, Mr. Sir, what's your favorite like part of Christmas, you know? That scene in particular, like, I was in a pretty like, probably this and the French Dispatch, because I had to go to a theater that's like not, it's that's playing more like this stuff. It was a little bit busier than like I'm used to at the movie theater that I go to, but this scene like killed in the theaters. Like, people thought this was like, it was like, there was lots of like awes and like like laugh out loud moments. And you know, the rest of the movie is fairly dark, you know, like in terms of content, much more than like scenery. So makes sense, but like that's, you know, I thought that those scenes in particular, the ones where she's with her kids, yeah, really show, you know, that like who she kind of wants to be versus who she's sort of, you know, being forced to be. While, you know, the other scene I thought worked really well is the one where she's, her and Charles are across the pool table, and he sort of admits like, yeah, we all have to have two of ourselves. Like, you have to have the person who you know, but even in that is like the person, you know, in here can't be the version of you that you're trying to be. Like, if you try to be that, like, both he's like, you could be there could be two versions of yourself, and neither one of them are ones that Diana like wants to be, right? I guess a little bit her public persona, like, we don't get that. Like, a big thing about Diana that is very so interesting about this movie is that she is beloved. She is she, and you know, she does really good work. It's also not like, you know, mince words, that like, she's also like a very attractive woman and was very, very popular as like somebody that Charles was marrying. And she's beloved by society. And it's a thing that like they kind of get into with like the pictures being taken, and she has that interaction with the queen. She's the queen, sure take a lot of pictures with you. Right. But
That was so cutting and so like such an effective use of like the littlest piece of dialogue that we get from the woman playing the queen.
A thing I think we've seen with this, like, you know, in this movie does really well in a lot of stories, that like basically they have this image to hold, and so they don't just like say what they like try to imply, or they get somebody else to do.
For sure. Yeah.
You know,
right. And even in these quote unquote private like moments where it's only like two or three people standing around, and to your point, they still have these like, I mean, it goes beyond protocol. It's like, do you even know how to be like a human anymore? Like, it's kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah. And so I think that, I think it was really an interesting choice to like dive in where we don't see the Diana who, is out mingling with people. There's this historic photo of Diana, right, where she like, shakes hands with somebody in a hospital who has AIDS, and one of the first people to like be willing to touch some, which is like wild, you know, but that was the case in the 90s. And so they just, and I think the thing that the movie does really well is it just places you in the middle of like Diana's like suffering, basically, right? Like, she purposely gets lost at the beginning of the movie, to the point where like the chef has to come and be like, oh, you're late, like, you should not
know. The queen will be here soon, like, this is a big deal, like, you have to be there before the queen is there,
like, please come. And so they just put you right in the middle of that, and I thought that was like a really interesting choice. And for her to basically be like stuck in this place, and they have the tech of like her wanting to leave to go to her old home, you know, as these like tools they use for her like trying to escape and break, you know, it just was like really, really well done. It's a really beautiful film too.
Yeah, for sure. It's shot beautifully, the music is great. To your point about like we get her, like, I agree, that's a really good point about the perspective that we get. Like, this is full of her private moments, really. Like, we don't always get, even if we don't get like a corresponding like inner monologue, we see what are essentially a lot of her thoughts, we see what are essentially a lot of her fears. Like, every once in a while we see something and we're not quite sure if it happened, if it was real. There are a couple of instances of like something happened, but then it turns out that she only imagined it. Speaks to like her hysteria a little bit. I mean, that's a charged word, but
the pearl soup scene certainly comes to mind.
That was crazy. Yeah, she's like, I'm gonna eat. She basically like rips off her shackles, her pearls that she's wearing, and they get in the soup, and she's like, she feels compelled to still eat it because she's in the presence of the queen, and she starts to like eat the pearls, which is sounds like a bad idea.
And the wire cutter, is that, are we, oh god, does she do that?
It seems like, my take on it was, as not a Diana expert, but at one point in my life, I was like really like reading up on a lot of stuff, about her life. Like, I think it was more about her causing herself harm, like doing self harm to herself. And like that being like, 'cause in the moment it's like she cut herself, and then it's like a little kid when like you do something knowing what's going to happen, but not really understanding the consequences of something. Yeah. And then you do it and you're like, oh shit, I did that thing and now like I cut myself and now I'm in like a strapless dress and my arm, like there's no way I can cover this blood mark that I have on my arm because I literally just gave myself a wound. It's yeah, to me it hinted at the possibility of like her harming herself. You know, we get like the shot of her like at the top of the stairs kind of like considering the worst. Like it's really sad. And like to your point about like we see, it's really interesting to me that the movie is pretty much told entirely from her perspective, but we don't start out with her. Like we start out at this place and then she is kind of introduced to it. Like we kind of see her in the wild and it's like this really fascinating thing to me of like, here's the neutral world or here's the neutral ground where this thing takes place. And now we're going to introduce her, not just her as a character, but her like state of mind, her neuroses, her valid feelings. Like, I don't want to like qualify it like, oh wow, she was out of control and like feeling things that don't make sense. Like everything that she felt and everything that she, all the thoughts that she had all come across as sympathetic and like as a quote unquote normal person would take this entirely like crazy situation. I can't even imagine what it would be like to have to act this way and like at all times and literally have no privacy, like maybe when you're having a moment with your kids.
But even then it has to be like, you know, under the guise of, you know, night, and she sneaks into the room and like there's all this like, even then, like there's many lines in this film that like, you know, are ways in which like she says something and then, you know, it seems like her trusted, you know, a trusted advisor, you know, and then somebody else is like, yeah, we heard about that. You're like, God, like what? Like, it's so, awful. It's just like everything you do, even when it's, you feel like you're like alone with another person, whatever, is being scrutinized, you know, to the nth degree, you know, totally, you know, I feel like, you know, lots of people struggle with like mental health issue, you know, in this movie, she's struggling with an eating disorder, and thoughts, self-harm and whatnot. We'll before the end of this section, we should put in just links if you're having thoughts, or, you know, we should put in some numbers and things like, we'll put that at the end of the segment. You know, but like, yeah, it's like that is stuff that happens to people. And then you add on like the weight of, you know, how much she's being scrutinized and watched and critiqued, you know, to the point where like she wants to switch which dress she's wearing for one day. And they're like, somebody's going to think that's my fault and we can't have that, you know? So
it's crazy. It's yeah. One of the few, I would say like non-Diana focus scenes is like this one random cutaway where we get, it's that line that you just mentioned where like her dresser, the person who is like hired to dress her, is having a conversation with the Timothy Spall character who's basically like in charge of the house. And he's like, I don't know. And she's basically like, I don't know. Should I say something? She wore that wrong dress. I don't want to like upset her, but also I don't want somebody else to blame me. Like, this is the kind of stuff. Like, it's like this one little drop that we get in the bucket of like this conversation, but it's so clearly speaking to, this is the kind of conversation that's taking place at all times around these people, by this like infrastructure of this army of people who work for them, basically. It felt very much like Downton Abbey, except none of the people working are like the most interesting part of the thing. It's like kind of the opposite in a way.
I think there was one, I thought, is it Sally Hawkins?
Oh, Maggie.
I thought Sally Hawkins was really great.
The character of Maggie, for sure.
But everybody else kind of sucked. That's not true. I thought, I thought Sean Harris, the head chef, is interesting too, but.
Yeah, he seemed, he was like, what I think you could say about a lot of people like this, like Maggie was like outwardly, and Maggie actually gets sent away, so it makes sense that I forget about her. Because Prince Charles is a POS, at least in the movie. Sorry, real Prince Charles. Don't sue me. Like Maggie is sent away and then she comes back at the end. But the cook, the one that you're mentioning, like a lot of people, like seeing that she's in pain, seeing that like, like able to look past the, oh, she just wants attention, or, oh, you know, whatever excuse you want to put on, like, what are obviously just mental health problems. But like not doing anything, like just stopping short of being kind, like the kindness just being the acknowledgement of her feelings. But even then being like, you kind of have to push through that.
I do think there's a way in which like this is an old school, that is a very old school mentality. He does, like, I feel like he tries these things that I feel like make sense when we were not having realistic conversations about mental health, which is like, I made you the nice dessert. It's like, yeah. Okay.
Personally, that's very nice. I personally made it for you.
But it will not fix my depression, you know? To me, it's like very much like that makes, you know, kind of fits with like, you know, this is 1991. It's not like we were having like full, I certainly wasn't, I was a little baby. So we were not having like full conversations.
Grace, you were so ahead of your time being in this movie, talking about mental health as a baby.
My first words were, yeah.
Your first words,
therapy. Mental health. So I don't know.
I am Grace.
But then, gosh, Timothy Small, the head guy, that guy sucks. Oh, that guy sucks so much.
He like wants to like essentially grab her. There's that one scene where they're like sitting outside. He's like, I don't think they called her Your Grace, but they called her like Your Majesty or Your Royal Highness, whatever. It's like, I insist that you must blah, blah, blah. Come here. I'm like, what are you going to do? Are you going to actually physically grab her? Because now I'm wondering, did the queen tell you that that was okay? Because nothing would surprise me. Just like appearing like this really like, how can I describe it? Like
the kitchen scene, the freezer scene.
Yes,
is
I was
like,
just gonna say, like this very suffocating, like almost like put a pillow over, like it's just like so effed up the way, like the scene you're mentioning, like Diana basically, like I think it's Christmas night or Christmas Eve still.
It's like it's like the probably I assume like the night of Christmas Eve heading into Christmas Day, I think.
Yeah, and she basically, you know, she doesn't want to eat in front of these people. She doesn't like them. She also has her issues, her
which her husband her also eating. Like
which nobody wants to give any time to. And it's like, oh, your things that you're dealing with. Well, like you're this like dramatic
rather than
person.
Supporting her, he says like, I would prefer that this food doesn't find the like toilet bowl
the
later.
Porcelain.
Like,
yeah,
he calls it like a off, Charles. Oh, gosh.
Shit. But yeah, in this scene, so she basically like sneaks into the, and again, in this very like the scenes by herself and some of the scenes with her kids, like there's just like very sweet childlike wonder, like clearly speaking to like this innocence that she had, or like the sense of like freedom that she only felt when she was either alone or only with her kids.
Yeah.
But she goes into the kitchen to basically eat food and like by herself, where she doesn't feel the weight of like the world. And she's in the kitchen, she comes in one door, and then he comes through like a trap door on the other side and is standing there for like 15 seconds just watching her eat like a creep. And she like has to like know, and then it's that other passive aggressive thing of like, not only do you sneak up on me, but like you're not going to announce yourself, because like you're the Royal Highness, let's say, and I'm this person who snuck up on you, but to clear my throat or to say or whatever would somehow be a betrayal of like this power dynamic. So I'm just going to like meekly stand here, which even though it's like almost worse.
Again, she's treated like a child, right? Like it's like she's sneaking into the kitchen, and then I'm going to like sit and wait for you to notice, and then you're going to know that you did something wrong. Like, not me. It's like, it's brutal. He also like very, this is like psychological, like manipulation. He puts the book about Anne Boleyn in her bedroom. We find out the end, 'cause he puts the book back on the shelf from the thing. So it's like very, I mean, maybe they're trying to say something differently, but I do feel like they're saying he puts the book there, which is, you know, if you don't follow the rules, you're going to get your head chopped off. So, you know, maybe not like, I think like in modern times, it's not that blatant, but like, you know, they wouldn't actually do that, but it's very much like, Here's what happens if you're not obedient, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I love that to your point, that's such a great detail of like them making sure to show you that he had been the one that left the book, because I think there are, as I already said, there are some things that happen that kind of Diana imagined, or like you think like she might just be being paranoid about, but she finds the book, knows it's him. And then we see that he in fact does, like you said, return the book to the bookcase, and it's like, oh god, you really are as bad as we all thought you were.
Yeah. Did the ghost of Anne Boleyn, did that work for you at all?
it worked.
Was she working? Was it working for you? Work it, Anne.
Work it, Anne Boleyn. I love that one part. I can't remember who said it, where it was like, they were talking about like the Boleyn sisters. And I was like, I forgot which one's which. Like, yeah, oh, yeah, that's yeah. Like one of them got her head chopped off. I think it did work overall. Like, it worked more than it didn't. I think there was a part, like, I think her first appearance got a really big laugh. Because
oh, really?
I think it's like her, I think it's when she's sitting at the table and like she imagines the queen as, if I'm remembering correctly, she imagines the queen as Anne Boleyn, but you don't know it's Anne Boleyn yet, or at least I didn't. I didn't realize it till later. I thought it was more just like a puritanical thing, but she appears later in like a much more harrowing instance and basically like saves Diana's life. I think it did work. I think in the realm of like, this is her private world and this is like her imagination. And again, there's something like super childlike about it in a good way that's presented throughout the movie. I think it definitely works in that sense. What about for you?
It's probably the thing that kind of works the least for me in this movie. Yeah. Like it's fine to be, it doesn't ruin the movie for me that she's like hallucinating and seeing Anne Boleyn, but like it feels a little bit silly when she's like, who is she talking to Maggie later? And she's just like, well, Anne Boleyn saved my life last night. And I'm like, yeah, okay. All right, yeah, sure.
Maggie's like nodding her head. Like, yes, sweet child.
Maddie's like, I am in love with you. Yeah. I don't know. This movie that there was, I think the Anne Boleyn thing is one that I'm like, yeah, okay, I get the like metaphor, but I think it, you know, it works without maybe seeing her, but whatever, it's fine. It's a creative choice, and you know. And then the other thing is Maggie coming out is a thing that I feel like the movie is like, we should have an LGBTQ character. We should, like, Diana was very like, you know, LGBTQ like friendly, but yeah. Like, I don't know. It feels like it comes at the end of the movie with like very, I don't know if this ever really gets addressed, but like Maggie gets sent away, but like they do reveal that like Maggie does tell somebody that Diana is like probably like having a mental break, which could have been a thing that she's saying, like advocating that she needs help for.
Right,
it could
right,
be
right.
Like hey, like if we don't do, we should help this person who like she's in love with. But mm-hmm. I thought the like I'm in love with you thing, I don't know, it's like this felt like maybe this movie's trying to be like, you know, oh, there'll be a gay character.
We're
you know?
Allies.
It's like we're out, yeah. You know. And I don't know. I don't. Maybe if it's true, if like Maggie is based off a real person who has like admitted that she was like in love with Diana and told her, and you know they were friends anyway. Like, okay, that's better probably, but I just don't know if that's actually true or not. So
yeah, no, I think that's valid. I think. It's interesting to me, like, I think whether or not she said the thing, whether or not Maggie actually said that thing of like, oh, Diana, it's like, you know, mentioning her mental problems. I couldn't really make out one way or the other where the movie landed on if that actually happened, because as we said many times, like there are things that happen in the movie that are like, they try to, like, whether the movie or the people make you think it's paranoia, but regardless, the way that this thing does work for me, and I agree with you that it, at the time, it took me out of it enough that I was thinking, is this working for me? Like, in the moment, I'm thinking, okay, how am I receiving this? Which, you know, if it's completely organic, you're not having that thought. But anyway, I was like, okay, here's what makes sense to me. What makes sense to me is that people love her. We've already said she's super well-loved, especially compared to everybody else in that horrible family. She's very well-liked. She has... she has a reputation for being kind to people, and there are obviously endless amounts of like public kindnesses that we saw her do. But I loved the idea of like, Diana is worried that nobody's being honest with her. And like, this is the most honest that you can be with someone, like to a fault. Like there's mm-hmm. something like irresponsible about like admitting this, like you're on the staff, like there are all these like layers of appropriateness, whether okay. things are appropriate or not.
Yeah, as somebody who's come out many, many times, yeah. You know, that's fine. You know, tell someone when you feel comfortable.
The
but
idea
yeah.
of using it, yes, I would hope that like this isn't like her first time coming out. This is like she's very comfortable in herself. The only people she's private with are these royal people. But the idea that like she would be super honest with Diana as a way to like almost like shock her into believing her. Like Diana is at that moment, like in this headspace of like, I don't know who to trust. I don't know who's being real with me, blah, blah, blah. Like, I kind of trust you, Maggie. I certainly trust you more than anybody else. But like, and then her coming back to her and being like, wow, that's kind of, not only is that super honest, but that's like potentially like you putting yourself in a little bit of danger, unfortunately.
No,
of like, yeah, 100%. You know,
I absolutely would be fired from her job.
So yeah. Like, I loved that part of it where it was like,
all right,
we're going to use this in a different way. Like, again, I don't love the idea of like her, like almost weaponizing her outness in this way against Diana. But like the fact that she's like, listen, I trust you or, you know, and I'm going to say this thing. I think I've said enough about it, but
I don't think it was weapon. I didn't see her weaponizing it. I did feel like it was a, like, you know, sort of the sweet moment. I was not expecting there to be like LGBTQ representation in this film. And I didn't think that, you know, Maggie's character was out. And then so for me, I'm like kind of like looking of like, okay, why was it done? But I actually really love the reason you just gave, that like she doesn't know who she can trust. And specifically, Maggie is somebody who Diana is worried that the trust has been broken with. Right.
Exactly.
Right? And she's still, like, she has nobody else because she's still clinging on to people. So then for Maggie to basically like say something that probably does definitively prove that she like trusts Diana, and that she like, like loves her. And this is not, I think it's probably more powerful, I guess, than like Diana being loved. Again, the thing I was saying earlier about like, I think a lot of the ways people love Diana in some ways was superficial. Like she's, mm-hmm. she's beautiful. She's a beautiful young woman. Right. And like, as somebody who's also a beautiful woman, it's not enough to be, you want to be loved for who you choose to be, right, how you, right. You know, there's a thing where like, I try not to compliment people in my everyday life about appearance necessarily. Mm-hmm, I like to make, the comments I try to give are like things that people choose, you know, and it can be about your clothing, but it's like, your taste in like, you know, clothing. It's like something that you're choosing to do. It's why I think, you know, and you go on this existential thing, but it was a thing we tried to like tell people when I was working at camps and with people, you know, it's like, try to like, you know, you don't know how people feel about how they look, but also like, it's not, you know, even if somebody is like, you know, traditionally, you know, from traditional standards of beauty, beautiful, you don't know how it affects them. So like, try to like compliment people on like, you know, things that, you know, they have chosen and choose to do and whatever. And so I kind of do like in this moment, it is this thing where like Maggie's saying more, you know, she's not saying she loves her because she's beautiful. That is probably partially true, but it's also because like, of who Diana is as like a person, and Maggie saying, I love you. And it goes a little bit further than just being, you know, maybe at the end of this movie, it's a little like corny for her to be like, I want to be your friend. You know, it's like, it's like more than that. And Maggie, I know, I think like for people out in the 90s, like you have to know that, like, you know, actually nowadays too, like to come, like coming out to somebody and like being, like, you know, oftentimes there's people that you like, you are like, I am attracted to you. And they're like, not into the, you know, you as a person. So like, I don't know. Sure. I thought the scene was like very interesting. I've been thinking on it. I think when I walked out of the theater, I was like, yeah, I don't know if I love that, but I think from the example that you gave, I actually do. It's growing on me, I think. So
yeah, it was sweet. And I think they both play it really well, you know, two great actresses. And it's sweet. And by that point at the end, you're just like, oh God, please, Diana, like you need something good in your life for the end of this movie.
I love the scene of them in the car driving away. I loved the like panning over to the scarecrow that she had taken her father's jacket off, and it has one of her like dress. Most famous outfits. And then her driving the car, and they just, and she goes to the drive, they're at KFC at the drive-through, which to me is like a very 90s thing of like,
a very cool end. Like, and they had mentioned fast food earlier, and I just wondered, which one are they going to choose? Like, where are they going to end up
singing in them singing in the car? And it just like did car, make me sad. Like, I think about like Meghan and Harry choosing to step away from the royal family. I think about I have a lot of like, you know, respect for Meghan choosing to do that based on what I'm presume the hate that she got and very unjustified, you know, racism, mm-hmm. you know, sure. And I feel like her, you know, her staying in the situation would have like, it's not that dissimilar from like Diana's struggles of feeling like, wow, this is like, you know, a suffocating nightmare. And I just think of Harry, who's somebody who like, you know, he lost his mom at such a young age. you know, partially because of like the attention and the, you know, the stress she was under. And now for him to be in a relationship with this woman, then she's like, to me, I, you know, they make the choice together, but ultimately she's, you know, we should leave. And I'm saying, yes, let's do that. And I just like, I just could not help but thinking about like him, you know, and William to, you know, to lose your mother is hard, but them sitting in the car singing the song, belting it out with the top down was like so cute. I thought it was so good.
Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, and just, you know, as we wrap up on it here, like, I think that's such a good point, because that's something that struck me so much watching it, is like, it's so poignant to watch and obviously sad. Like, I will try not to sound too positive about it, but it's just like the beauty of what like art could be, you know, like just, we have this we have this context now of like where, and, you know, again, this is like our quadruple, quintuple, who knows how many layers removed from actual their reality. So who knows what these people are, but we have this idea of how her sons have turned out, in a lot of different ways. And it's just like so sad and sweet to see these things. Like when we see William say like, "Mom, are you okay?" Like William as the older kid is trying, is like, hold on, like give her some time, like is trying to someone who's been caught between parents, I can only imagine caught between royal parents, like trying to protect his mother in whatever small way he can, like not even understanding that maybe even she should be protected. And like Harry's so small, so little, and like to see where he is now, like, yeah, how can that not come to your mind? Like, I mean, he spoke about it in the interview that he did with Oprah, but like, and you know, Oprah kind of like spoon fed them that like line of logic, but, or that trail of thinking. But I think it really is so fascinating, seems like a shitty word to use, but it really is so interesting to you know, to watch them, to watch her or a version of her interact with these kids, knowing that this is it's moments like this that she got, and they never got to have a lot of adult conversations. It's sweet. It's sweet in a way that I think works really well for me personally.
I'm glad that the movie didn't do, you know, I mean, Charles gets, you know, not the greatest, but I like that. Yeah. There's these like moments of them on the screen, whether or not that's fair, like, you know, it's still, you know, maybe this invasion of their life, but like, I don't know. The scene was very cute. And both scenes where it was like just the kids, and the scene where, is a Christmas dinner, and she runs into William's room, and before she said like, "I need you to tell me if I'm acting silly," and he's like on the door being like, "Mom, you're acting like you told me to tell you, and you're acting silly."
It's happening. It's happening. It's so sweet and sad. It's like, yeah, this poor kid. It's a lot of hard stuff to have to deal with. But
yeah. I'll just say, as we like, you know, we're talking about, you know, mental health, you know, self-harm, stuff like that. The number, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline in America, 1-800-273-8255. In Canada, 1-833-456-4566. There are people you can talk to if you need help, you're struggling with something, give them a call. There are people out there who will talk through with you. You're loved, you matter, all that stuff. Because I think this, Spencer, there's a lot of that stuff in that movie. And there also is some stuff in the movie we're about to get into. So, yeah.
I appreciate that, Grace. Thank you. So, yeah, I guess on that note, let's take a quick beat, some time for our sponsors to get a word in, and we'll be right back.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Okay, and we're back. So yes, we are here to talk about another British movie. Last Night in Soho. Soho is a place in London. For those of you that didn't know, it's a place in London.
Yeah.
This is a psychological horror film directed by Edgar Wright, starring Thomasine McKenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy are the two big leads, and then also Matt Smith and Diana Rigg. Yeah. Shout out to Diana Rigg. I didn't realize at the time of seeing this that this was her last on-screen role. Since she unfortunately passed last year, I believe.
Yeah, God, yeah, that's sad.
The queen of the Queen of Thorns from Game of Thrones, Loras's grandmother.
Yeah.
Who's so, and it's funny because I heard her voice in this movie. I would just quickly say, and like, I'm used to seeing like the almost whole like nunnish like habit thing around her head. And I'm like listening to her voice and I was like, I know this person. And 2 seconds later, I'm like, oh my God, it's so Diana Rigg.
I knew that this was Diana Rigg's last performance before I went to go see the movie. And I totally forgot that was Diana Rigg in the movie. And then after I was like, oh yeah, that was Diana Rigg. Yeah.
See, that's how it goes sometimes.
Yep.
Okay. Grace, how did you feel about this movie?
What a good 2/3 of a movie. So, I don't want to spoil it, but like, I thought Thomasin McKenzie was really, really good in this movie. She's very cute. She's like, you know, I relate to the kid from the small town who then moves to the big city. Like very much. I feel that. I thought it was great. I thought the music was so good in this movie. Mm. Like it was so perfect. And yeah, I like the idea of her, like, you know, being transported back and like living in her dreams, living vicariously in the 1960s, and slowly that, like, that idea of that being fun unraveling. And yeah, I just thought it was fun. You know, fun is again, the wrong term, but I thought it was a good movie. It's pretty well acted. And then the plot sort of loses steam, I think, towards the end. But still, I think, worth seeing. Yeah, still worth seeing. So, yeah, I would still check it out.
I think I agree mostly. I think I was a little less hard on it, but we'll parse out the ending stuff a little later. But yeah, I agree that Thomasin McKenzie, like, I was actually a little bit worried going into it because, like, I really like Anya Taylor-Joy, as a lot of people do. Really great actress, has shown that she can do a lot and in various roles. And, like, I was kind of worried about this main character, like, being able to keep up, basically, acting-wise. And she does a great job. Like, I think they're totally equals in a lot of ways that work really well for the film. And it's fun. Like, it's a vibe, as the kids would say. I think the movie does a good job of like kind of establishing itself and keeping that vibe throughout towards the end. No, for sure. It was never boring. Yeah, I think for sure it's worth seeing. Especially if you like British things, if you like tea and you like Soho.
60s music, 60s fashion. Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
You'll like this movie.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. Speaking of fashion, I mean, I guess we can
let's jump into it.
Yeah. We can jump into spoiler territory here, but Matt Smith, I was not expecting, like, I maybe it's the Mad Men style fashion that I was like shocked. Like, I have never felt feelings awaken within me about Matt Smith. And then when I saw, as dirtbaggy as he is in this movie, as a horrible piece of shit human that he is, I was watching his outfits. I was like, oh, excuse me, Matt Smith. I didn't know you could do that with your hair.
I thought the, like, yeah, the costume design in this movie was like really, really good. Poor like Ellie comes to the big city like wearing her own outfit and friggin' Hurricane Jocasta is like she made her own outfit to like, you're in fashion school, you like, idiot.
Isn't that the point?
And it looks cute. It's like, she looks so cute. And also, Jocasta, Ellie's like sees her mom's ghost, so like F off. Like, get out.
Sorry that you're not cool enough to see a ghost.
Like, what the hell? The heck?
Sorry, not sorry, but like, Jocasta, really? I don't know. I mean,
Hurricane Jocasta.
And then she's so mean throughout the whole movie. Misses no opportunity. Literally roofies this girl. Roofies her and her friend. Or no, I guess only roofied her, it seemed like. Like, so cruel, so real crime and mean and evil.
Jocasta never gets what's coming. She almost gets stabbed in the face, but other than
that, real crime is that Jocasta doesn't get murdered by old Anya Taylor-Joy.
Okay, all right, okay. So big big picture thoughts. Okay, we like started with Hurricane. We started with Matt Smith as director, and then we got to Hurricane Jessica. But the point of this movie, right? Ellie sleeps in this. You know, she's in this room when she falls asleep. She like lives vicariously through Sandy, mm-hmm. through Sandy's life and what's happening to her, and then slowly, you know. Ellie thinks that Sandy was murdered, but you know, and so she's sort of like losing it and thinking that the guy, Lindsay, the guy who's like at the bar, she thinks that must be Jack, Sandy's like manager / boyfriend / pimp. He thinks that must be him. And so she's like trying to cute. And then that turns out to be false. He's actually like a police officer who might've been like trying to investigate what happened. And so the piece of this movie at the end that really doesn't work for me is there for the sake of this twist that the landlord is Sandy. That's, you know, that's the big twist of this movie, right? Sorry if I spoke, but we said we're doing the spoilers. So Sandy is the sandlord.
The slumlord, the slandlord.
So Sandy's the landlord. So they want this plot twist of like Ellie being like, we have to figure out what happened to this girl. She was murdered, thinking that Jack is still out there. No, it turns out that Sandy has lived in this apartment her whole life. She murdered Jack as well as countless other men that she like, I guess, hid in the floorboards. And now their spirit. So there's this moment in the film that I was like, I know I'm not supposed to, and I don't, but I'm not relating with the creep bags. I can't relate to the men who like bought Sandy. Right. But you kind of want me. They're all looking at me with like a sad face and a no face. And they're all like, help us. It's like, yeah, well, you shouldn't have been murdered, but also you shouldn't have abused this young woman.
You shouldn't have let yourself get murdered.
I don't know. I guess it's the idea that like, though, I mean, I know that those men don't deserve to be murdered just because you can pay money for, that's fine. You can do that. It should be legal. Right, sex work should be legal. And you should, the sex worker should not murder them. But at the same time, I was like, this is like a cycle of violence that this woman is experiencing. Mm-hmm. And especially like some of these men that she, I don't know. Where's so then I'm like, okay, well now I don't understand that. Like, okay, now like Sandy's crazy. She was crazy and she's a murderer. And then it's like, no, I will sit in the fire and I will die. And then that will be my redemption. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, what? What? You just like almost killed.
So unhinged.
You just almost killed Ellie and her cute little boyfriend. So.
Okay. So to recap very quickly. Yes. Cause I love it. I love hearing it all. Like that stream is making me so happy. And
just because there's a moment where all the like dead men are looking like, help us. And it's just like, well,
we spent a lot of the movie being like, what do these men want? Like, what do these ghost men want? Okay. So, so to recap very quickly, Ellie goes to fashion school in London. Then she moves into the top floor of this house where the old lady Diana Rigg lives. Yes. Then you come, and then she's like having her like dream world. When she goes to sleep, she inhabits Sandy's body. And then she's like going through this, and Sandy's having a great life. But then Sandy in the dream world starts to have like a shittier life, where like Matt Smith's character starts to basically pimp her out, like unbeknownst to her. Like it's not like they had a conversation about it. It was like,
she has an audition. Like you're going to be the star of the show. And then she's like the third backup dancer, you know, it's like, oh shit, it's not going like, yeah, she's not having a breakup.
Like, you're going to be huge, but you're also going to be a prostitute, which again, isn't a bad thing, but like it would be great.
It is when you're being forced to do it.
Right. If you're being forced. And again, you weren't told. Yeah. So then like Sandy, for obvious reasons, starts to kind of get depressed and have like a shitty life and drink a lot and like kind of spiral downwards. And then Ellie starts to kind of spiral also for different reasons. And then what basically happens is like Sandy, we find out later, Sandy like starts to murder these men that she is like required to sleep with. And the way she's getting away with it is because I guess in the 50s and 60s, their, you know, police were like crappier. And she just hides the bodies like in the cupboards and it doesn't smell. Okay, whatever. We can just skip through that. And then now Sandy lives downstairs as the old landlady. So it's the same person that we don't know this at the beginning. We find this out at the end. So it's a lot to keep track of. And then she like tries to, they do this thing where like they show you, it feels very like almost like Sixth Sense. In a way where like they show you right before they show Ellie realizing that old lady is Sandy, they show like a piece of mail that the old lady had gotten that's like in Sandy's name, but it happens really quick.
Can I tell you my worst fear in this moment? So when
I thought it was her, I thought it was going to be her.
No,
as an old woman,
when she thinks that like Jack is the guy who's at the bar, like the Terrence Stamp, when she thinks that that's Jack, and she confronts him, and then he dies, and then the bar owner is like, that's not Jack, that's Lindsay, he's a police officer, and like I was like in my head like, oh my god, the friggin' landlady is gonna be Jack, it's gonna be like a trans like oh no, like it's immediately where my brain like, they're doing a trans thing, it's like no you can't, and
it's not working,
and then it turns out that like the landlady is just Sandy.
It's Sandy. It's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I will say the one way that this works for me, and I use like very lowercase w, is like my worry going into it and my worry even throughout the movie is like, okay, now how are you going to make Sandy matter? Because like Sandy matters in the movie a lot. And I'm not saying they got it right. I'm just saying, you know, Sandy matters a lot. And like Ellie is basically inhabiting her body. But like, what now? Like, what does that mean for Sandy in the current day? Or like, obviously maybe Sandy's dead, but like, what does that mean for the character? How are we going to get payoff? And the fact that like the character was still there worked for me. Now that the fact that the character had turned into like a murderous like serial killer is a different story.
I agree, because I feel like what the story is like, you know, in the flashbacks is basically trying to say, it's like, look at this shitty thing that happened to Sandy, and like in some I sort of wish like the thing that didn't work for me in this movie is Sandy like drugging Ellie and trying to kill Ellie and her boyfriend. Everything else up to that specific point 100% works in this movie. And then, but then like the whole point that Sandy becomes a murderer is she's killing men who are like abuse, like, and maybe like that, maybe what I'm missing is that like all of these men weren't abusing her, but like just make that the story. Like all these men who like treat her terrible, like she like a little Dexter stuff, you know, right, and not that, right. You know, check out the Dexter coverage on Bosha Recaps. Team Josh. Like have her have this like code, like when you reveal that all of these people are dead because Sandy killed them and was hiding that, have it be like, I killed the ones who abused me, who knew I didn't want to be like, have sex with them. And have those die. And then at the end of the movie, you can have like, and I guess you need someone else to have this, like the climactic moment of like the house needs to burn down and, you know, Sandy needs to die or go, you know, right, whatever. Right. But it's the piece of the story that like, why Sandy has not been trying to kill just anybody. Right. And I feel like there's like this thing of like her being in the house that's like, you know, being there. And she sort of, you know, I don't know. The piece that didn't work for me is like, she's suddenly like, well, now I have to kill you, Ellie, because I'm going to get caught, you know? And that's the piece that like emotionally, it doesn't make sense, because ultimately they want the Sandy redemption thing at the end of her, like sacrificing herself, sitting in the house, right? They want that moment of like a little bit of this, like, okay, you can leave and I'll sit here and I'm going to pay for all the bad stuff I did by sitting here and dying in this fire. Why can't you just have all that stuff happen without her needing to try to kill Ellie? It doesn't make sense.
Those two things are inextricably linked. We can't do one without the other.
Well, they want this like,
I don't know,
climactic scene where like, oh, I'm the bad person, but I feel
right. It's like that, like literally walking towards the camera and you have the unease and you're like, wait a minute. Wait, is something bad about to happen? Oh, she's the killer. Like it's
well,
like,
you can have that moment, and then she could have this thing of being like Ellie, the reason I did it is because like these men were terrible, and I, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then I don't know.
Now that you mention it, it honestly would have even made more sense if there was even like a little change where like she's like, Ellie, let's kill him. Like Ellie's boyfriend, where Sandy's right. Like, Ellie, men are shit, let's get him, and then you'll be free. Like that.
The one thing I will say,
she would have been like, Ellie, you never paid your rent on time. I'm going to kill you as your landlord because now I care about
Sorry,
income taxes.
We might have to edit that out because my computer cam, my headphones came undone. So we could jump. We'll have to like jump back in. I'll cut that. Sorry. Okay. It might echo, like your voice will echo because it comes from my speakers. Yeah, what were you saying? You're doing a thing. No, okay. What if, like, in this movie, I feel like you could do something where, like, yeah, Ellie's kind of with a shitty partner. But the one thing I actually really did love about this movie, one thing I thought that was, like, really, really well done was you did have a bunch of, obviously, like, Hurricane Jocasta is, like, is totally sucks. She totally sucks. She's really bad. And clearly Ellie is struggling. But the boyfriend... what is his name? I can't remember. It does matter. John, fashion student, and the teacher, I thought, are both really good. It was a really good modern view on supporting somebody who's struggling with mental health issues, where John just kept saying, like, please talk to me. Like, I will listen to you and I will believe you. Like, please tell me. And I sort of liked the contrast between, like, somebody struggling in the past and then somebody struggling in the present and what the people around them who care about them. Ellie's grandmother is really sweet as well. When she says, like, your mother, and there's also this thing about, like, Ellie was, when she's at home, she's seeing her mom who died and committed suicide. And so when she's on the phone, when she's saying that she's out at the bar with her friends, and then she says, okay, no, fine, I'm actually working. And she says, like, please, like, if you need to come home, that's okay. We can talk about it. Please get help, because your mother didn't get help. And then she couldn't take it anymore. And I just thought that, like, I guess you could have this thing where, like, I guess you could still have it with Sandy being like, oh, where she's just like, so she just sees every man as like, as terrible, and every man is out to get, you know, every man sort of, you know, that could be a little, maybe that's something. I guess it is just like her turning on Ellie that I struggle with, because you could even have where she goes after, if Ellie's saying, like, you know, John's being like, come with me, let's leave. And then Ellie's like, yeah, I'm going with him. And Sandy can be like, you can't go with him. He will ruin your life. Like, you know, if we know that's not true, then Sandy's turn on Ellie, you know, it starts to become justified. But there's not enough justification for why Sandy is doing what she does at the end of the movie for me. And I think what I was thinking about, they could have this like shitty boyfriend, but I actually love that most people in Ellie's life now are very supportive and sort of like approach supporting someone with mental health in the way that like, should. So I thought that stuff was all like, I really, really loved that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. And I think it was nice to see, to your point, and like very warm. And, you know, that contrast, like you said, is very interesting and obviously very tragic in a lot of ways, of just like Sandy's character is basically like told, like, be quiet, have a drink and get back to work. You know, like there's no room for a conversation, let alone, you know, understanding of like what mental health even is. And I thought, like, I kind of mentioned this earlier, but like my big fear was like there was going to be, because my brain is pretty much just like wired for like sci-fi fantasy stuff. So in my brain, I'm immediately like, oh my God, is she somehow her mother? Like, she's going to be like some weird time loop thing. Like that's like the first place I will always go to, no matter what genre the thing actually is. So I think I was just more pleasantly surprised, like, or like that she was her mom somehow, you know, like the person she's seeing was like her mom. But I'm glad that wasn't.
Did you get the sense, like, what did you make of at the end when she sees her mom and then she sees Sandy in the mirror at the end of the movie? Is that like, Edgar Wright being like, let me do a sequel. Kind of felt like it.
Ellie 2, Mom Harder. No.
Well, it's the last night in Soho, so it can't, you know.
Right, so it's like, or a prequel sequel, like, and to penultimate night in Soho.
I love when a movie title, when like you don't exactly know what it means. And then I just thought like the title of this movie is actually very clever, that like every night she relives the last night is like the last night she experienced a night in Soho. You're like, gosh, that's like pretty, it's pretty good. It's pretty clever.
Right. And then for some people, it was their last,
their last night in Soho. It's so like works on many layers. Yeah.
Edgar Wright, you should make movies for a living. What do you
do? Yeah, what do you do? He actually he makes some of my favorite movies ever. So I was very Hot Fuzz is like his Shaun of the Dead, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. He's done some of my favorite stuff.
Yeah, no. He for sure is a well-known.
He should keep doing it though.
Yeah. A well-known a well-known director. So I guess on that lovely note, is there anything else you want to say in closing about this movie?
Perhaps
something over dessert. Would you like a cup of tea while we finish up?
I thought that the camera work and cinematography of this movie was like the editing, I guess much more than the cinematography of like the even the first night that Ellie is like living through Sandy's like memory, like coming into the building and like when she looks in the mirror, it's like her, and there's some really clever shots of like Sandy coming down the stairs, and it's like this like it's like a bunch of mirrors rather than one, and like everyone has Ellie in it. I just thought that like some of the editing stuff was there's like, you know, when she's like with a Jack and it, again, like the use of mirrors and like it's a lot of mirrors, but there's like a back room where there's a mirror and like it's like Jack on one side and then like her Sandy on one, and then like in the other mirror it's like Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought like it was like visually really interesting, and again that's what I was saying, like this movie is pretty interesting, I thought it was like it's captivating the whole way through, even if I'm like, you know, angry about the end of the movie and like the decision, like the plot points and the character choices they made, it's still like interesting, it's still like I'm like what, you know, I'm watching it, I'm not like falling asleep in the theater, Drew. You know, so yeah.
Full circle, we're still watching you, Drew.
Yeah, unfortunately, this movie did not do well at the box office. $43 million budget, made about $13 million. So
was that like 1960s? Did we adjust for inflation? Is that? I'm just asking. Also, is that in pounds? Is that in sterling pounds?
Yeah. Yeah.
From the Great British. Whatever.
You know that not everything is the Great British.
The Great British last night in Soho. Great British Spencer.
Uh-huh,
Grace, this has been so nice.
Yeah, it's been fun. Very British of us.
Have you seen anything else? Perhaps something across the pond.
Well, I think they did cover it on Everything is Super this week, so check that out. Josh Wigler and Kevin Mahadeo. But I did watch Eternals. I very much liked it. I'm seeing mixed reviews from people.
Grace, what did you like about it? We can just talk about it real quick for like 2 minutes.
I thought that for a movie with such a large cast, like 10 superheroes you're like introducing all at once, who have a vast amount of history. Like if you are not familiar with Eternals, they're immortal. They've been around since the beginning of time on Earth. They were like created at the same time Earth was created to basically like watch over the planet. And you have like 7,000, 8,000, I guess, I don't know, more than, I guess since people have been around.
Who can say?
Whatever. I'm not a scientist.
We're not Melissa Woodward, yeah, or like,
come on. So I don't know. That's a lot. That's a lot of years to like make these people feel like they are real people with like history that like spans thousands of years. And I just thought like I was invested in all 10 main characters from this movie. And I thought it was like really, really well done. I thought that like the stakes of the movie worked for me. I thought it was like visually very compelling. It has like, I think like the locations were very cool. So I liked it. I feel like people should go check it out.
I can't eat steak. You mentioned steak. I thought very quickly this movie was beautiful,
yeah,
and obviously shot very impressively, directed by Chloe Zhao, which is a very big deal, but also had like some really beautiful like poignant emotional moments.
Mm-hmm.
But it also was like a little bit confounding to me, like just in the sense of like fascinated with some of the choices that were made and fascinated with like I don't know, it just felt like some of the people were in a different movie. Like I feel like a little bit some of the tone was a little bit all over the place with some of the actors versus some of the others. Like I think some of the others were like very much establishing a connection between each other and had like chemistry and were like in this movie, and then a couple of them it was like this person is not in the same movie. It's not that they're a lesser actor, it's just that these things don't really feel like they're of a piece. Mm-hmm. But I think it's fascinating, like that kind of stuff you know, to a point we made earlier, it was never boring. And I was kind of worried. That's part of the reason I moved my time to 9 a.m. the next morning, because I was worried it was going to be boring based on some of the reviews. And I was never really bored. But it was just, it was like a genuinely fascinating thing to watch of like, what is working, what is ringing true for me and what isn't. But I think it's definitely worth watching. And with that kind of movie, the people who want to see it are going to see it regardless of what we think. So
true. And then also I feel like it is, you know, there's a little bit of like, it's getting a little bit hate bombed on some of the websites because there's a gay superhero. So I don't know.
I won't stand for it, Chris. I really won't. I won't. Not here.
Ariel is on this podcast. Wait, are you saying you won't stand for the bad reviews or you won't stand for a gay superhero?
It depends on which country I'm in and how many votes I'm trying to get. No, of course I'm kidding. Of course I'm standing against the nonsense hate. But yeah, that was something interesting. I saw this horror movie at the end of October, I think it was, or just a couple of days ago, called Antlers.
I saw some reviews of this
with what's her name from The Americans? Carrie.
Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell. Thank you. Damn it. The third Carrie.
Jesse Plemons, isn't it?
Carrie Plemons. You're right. This movie is like, what if you took a horror movie and then let's imagine that like both lightness and darkness, as far as like lighting in a movie, is a knob. Let's turn the knob all the way down, like all the way down, so you can't really see the movie. And then also let's turn like some of the dialogue all the way down. It was like seeing a movie like through like a peephole. It was just like, what's happening?
And what if we have antlers?
What if there are antlers coming out of the peephole?
Can I read the opening line of the plot on Wikipedia? In a small town in Oregon, Frank Weaver runs a meth lab out of an abandoned mine. That's the opening. That's the opening line. Oh, character. I mean, I guess like ever since Breaking Bad made it big, I guess, you know. All right. Yeah.
Great.
Guillermo del Toro produced this, right? So.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Please no. I will just say very quickly. This. You just read that log line and I didn't know that that happened. Okay. I didn't know that that happened in the movie. Honestly, I didn't.
This is a new game. Should we play a game at this point where I read the first line of a plot summary from Wikipedia and I'll take out any, like, you know, when there's an encrypting piece of evidence to what clearly what movie it is, but we play a game, right?
Oh, games are great. Yeah, I'm down for games.
All right, in the future, we'll play that. It would be great.
Yeah, I think we'd be great.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, I guess that's it. Everything else that we've seen, we'll be covering or we've already talked about. So yeah. I guess on that note, this has been great, Grace. I'm always so happy to talk to you about movies.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, we'll be back soon to talk about another couple of movies.
Should we tell them what we're going to cover next week? I think it's pretty fun.
Yeah. We'll be covering a couple of Netflix movies, kind of a first for us. A movie Passing with Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga, mm-hmm. and another Netflix movie called
The Harder They Fall.
Race. Yes, it's called The Harder They Fall.
It's a Western movie, a huge cast.
Incredible cast.
Idris Elba, Regina King.
Don't ruin it. It's a surprise for some people.
Don't ruin it. Okay, all right.
It's part of the surprise, I heard.
All right.
Anyway, so yes, we'll be back in your feed soon talking about those movies.
With a special guest in it.
All right, that part we'll leave out. That part we'll leave as a tease. Right. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.